Good afternoon, and welcome to the Eco News Report. My name is Beth Werner, and I'm the Executive Director of Humboldt Baykeeper, and your host this week for the Eco News Report. This is an exclusive feature of KHSU, brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the Eco News. Don't forget you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. Today my guest is Mike Manitas, and we will be speaking about the Humboldt Bay Power Plant. Mike taught environmental and energy-related courses for 31 years in Humboldt County and has been interested and involved in nuclear power for many years. In 1987, he taught a course at HSU called The Decommissioning of Nuclear Power Plants, dealing with specifically with the Humboldt Bay Power Plant. The Humboldt Bay Power Plant is located just east of King Salmon on the shore of Humboldt Bay. PG&E recently constructed a new power plant adjacent to the Humboldt Bay Power Plant and is now decommissioning and demolishing the older plant, which includes two gas-fired electrical generating units and one nuclear generating unit. This is a radioactive waste site, and Mike is part of a community advisory board that is representing the community voice to make sure that the site is cleaned up properly to protect our most precious resource, Humboldt Bay. Well, welcome, Mike.
Hi, Beth. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you got it. Thanks for all you're doing. Can you tell us a little bit about PG&E's community advisory board and how you were chosen and what the roles are?
Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission oversees the licensing and the decommissioning and everything that's associated with the nuclear power plant. When PG&E filed for a decommissioning plan back in 1987, the plan then was to just kind of sit on the plant for a while. Come around the year 2000, and PG&E was anxious to get started on a decommissioning process. They had a public meeting, and various people spoke. Of course, I was there speaking, as always. Because of my interest, because of my kind of knowledge, because I've been associated with that whole issue, I was chosen to represent Humboldt State on this advisory committee. The committee is made up of a wide variety of individuals. We have people from politics, people from government. We have residents who live near the area. So it's really a cross-section that's hopefully going to represent the public out there. And, you know, our goal is to kind of do whatever we can do. My speaking to you today is part of that. I'm trying to give information as to what's going on in this enormous and complex process.
Certainly, and since 1987, so how often do you meet?
Well, the committee meets about once every 2 to 3 months. Things are starting to get more interesting, and we may start to meet a little more frequently. But again, it's more of an opportunity to kind of keep our fingers on the pulse of what's going on at the power plant. And a lot has been happening. A lot has been already deconstructed. The two fossil units, if you drive by, you'll see that those no longer are there. Those have been taken down. What remains is the unit number 3, which is the nuclear unit. And I would say that we're about maybe halfway through that decommissioning of that nuclear unit.
Certainly. Well, you know, that dedication of you and the group is pretty amazing for all of that time. So we really thank you for that. So you had said that, you know, the two fossil fuel plants had been already decommissioned and were in the middle of the nuclear power generating facility. Can you tell us a little bit about the tour that you went on recently of the power plant and what you saw?
Okay. I've taken many, many tours of that power plant, and I've seen a lot of it. It's interesting. This plant was the second commercial power plant built in the United States, the first nuclear power plant built by a non-government entity, so PG&E. And it was a small nuclear unit, 63 megawatts, which is very small compared to the 1,000, 1,200, 1,500 megawatt units being built today. It cost $33 million in 1962 to build. Went online. Operated for 14 years, off and on, had some problems. It was a real learning experience, and was shut down because an earthquake fault was discovered running right underneath the plant. And the cost to upgrade the plant to withstand that potential was more than what would be generated if the plant continued to run its another 15, 16-year lifespan. So at that point, PG&E decided to shut the plant down. In the process of operating for 14 years, things became irradiated, contaminated, whatever word you want to say. When you have radioactive fissioning going on, produces an awful lot of different kinds of materials that in themselves are radioactive and will kind of contaminate pipe, will contaminate concrete, just all kinds of things that become quote-unquote dirty. And so the process that is going on right now, in this last tour we took a couple of weeks ago, we're touring the turbine and generator building, which, again, there's contamination on the walls, on the concrete. The walls are going to be scabbled or actually dug down to whatever depth is necessary to remove that radioactivity. In some cases, it might be an eighth of an inch. In some cases, there may be a crack or a screw or a bolt in the wall where it can go in 2 to 3 feet. So, again, it's a process of reading what radioactivity remains and how to best remove that so then the rest of the building can be deconstructed under hopefully normal situations.
So in the process of your tour, you were there and they were showing you, like, say, a wall per se where there was maybe potentially radioactivity there and how they're going about removing that.
That's right. Here's a big wall, and it's got a grid on it, and it's got all kinds of chalk marks and pen marks saying, oops, here's a hot spot here. You got to dig in here. Ooh, this is... So, yes, it's a very painstakingly tedious process in which you have to identify really what's going on.
Do you think there's any conversation about the difference, the trade-off between finding individual sites that are contaminated within that area? Or removing all of it? Or is that something that PG&E is discussing?
Boy, that's been a very interesting issue in terms of how much money, how much time, how much effort do you spend pinpointing certain spots and removing them rather than just saying, well, let's just take this whole wall out. But if you take the whole wall out, then you don't just throw it away. You would have to send that to a low-level radioactive waste site, and that gets to be expensive. There's transportation costs, there's political problems, it's not easy.
Certainly doesn't sound like it is. So you spoke a little bit about the Nuclear Regulatory Agency. What other local, state, or national agencies are involved in this process?
Well, the NRC really governs and regulates radiological material. So then they, you know, being a federal agency, kind of preempt any state or any other local agency. So they have their guidelines as to what has to happen to the materials, how they're classified, where they'll go, where they'll be stored, how clean the site will be. So there are regulatory guidelines that again, PG&E is required basically to follow. The other lead agency right now is the California State Department of Toxic Substance Control. And they kind of not only deal with, well, they don't really deal specifically with radiological materials, but they're the ones who would deal with cleaning up sites around the bay. So the balloon track, for example, it would fall under their jurisdiction to a certain degree. Again, any place where you have materials that are pollutants that can, again, impact the environment, whether it's air or water or soil, that's the lead agency. And so that organization, the state level, is going to kind of take charge. But then again, you have all these other agencies that have their finger in the pie. You have the Coastal Commission, you have, you know, local agencies that, again, the Harbor Commission should have a say in this. I mean, everybody should have a say into how clean this site is cleaned up to and at what level of cleanliness, you might say, is it left for future generations.
Certainly the definition of what the cleanup actually is a good next step. From when you were teaching the class in 1987 to where you are now, do you see a difference in how these sites are being cleaned up or how technology has changed?
Oh, I think the technology is really fascinating. It's just really, really amazing what engineers can really do today. But that doesn't dismiss or it doesn't really change the fact that this is a very, very complex, very, very expensive project to undertake. And the United States has today about 104 operating nuclear reactors. At one point, we had another 14 reactors. Most of those 14 have been or are in the process of going through decommissioning. So this is a very kind of new field that's happening. Yes, there is some experience. And again, some of the folks here are doing some things that they're inventing, and they're saying, wow, here's a technique that we're using here. We're going to pass this on to the industry because this can be used in anywhere where this kind of technology has to be incorporated. And so it's really a learning experience. But I'm going to say that decommissioning is still in its, not infancy, but maybe in its childhood.
Mm-hmm. Is there any collaboration between the advisory group in Humboldt, in Eureka, with other advisory groups for the other projects that are going on around the nation?
Oh, no, not really. And again, I think the advisory board here has, like I said, just been tuned into what the activities are. And so far, the activities have been, I've been pretty amazed at the progress and the things that have happened. I mean, this is a very contaminated site that has to be cleaned up, and so far it's being cleaned up. And so I'm really happy with the process, really, really pleased with the quality of personnel who are dealing with this. The folks that I deal with down at PG&E are all, I mean, most of them live here. This is their community. Most of them are good professionals, and they're doing a very, very good job. I tell them every time I see them, I say, you guys are doing a great job. You're spending our money very well.
Yes, our money. Yes, that's a good point. Well, so besides the financial constraints that the entire United States and beyond is facing right now, what do you recognize as some of the major challenges or major hurdles for them to get to the next step? And how do we define a cleanup that's an appropriate cleanup for our community?
Yeah, I think, you know, they have a plan. The action plan has been formulated years ago. And so they're on schedule. We're on schedule. Right now we're on budget, even though the budget does change every year or so. So I don't foresee any real major problems or challenges. I think the ultimate will be when all the radiological material is removed from above grade. There's always the question as to what remains that's kind of unseen. So what's in the ground 3 feet down, 10 feet down, 50 feet down? And that's an issue that I personally think is going to be a major issue to be discussed. And PG&E is very well aware of that. And I'm sure that they will do, quote unquote, the best that they can do. There's not just the moral issue of how clean is clean. There are a lot of other issues that get involved. And that's, to a certain degree, economics. How much is it going to cost to clean up this one little spot when, gee, is it really worth that expense? Another issue might be, gee, you try to clean up one particular spot, and in doing so, you expose and create a whole lot of other issues that wouldn't be there if you didn't focus on that one thing. So, I mean, it's not easy. It's not cut and dry. You can't just say, go on in and just remove everything, bring it down to zero. You can't do that. You have to, at some point, make a judgment call as to how clean is clean. And that's what I'm hoping when that point comes in a year or two down the road, that the community will have an opportunity to speak up and say, gee, it's our money. We're spending it. We're spending money to clean this up. How much are we willing to spend? How clean is clean? What do we feel the resource of the bay means to us right now? What do we want that resource to be for our children and our children's children?
I think that's great, you know, balancing the trade-offs between focusing on one spot versus the entire spot, removing everything. You know, it's not a linear progression. And I think that's something that we all need to remember, that this is something that's developing and we're going to find issues as we keep moving forward and, you know, identifying the priorities within ourselves and with our communities and what we expect for the site. As far as the site goes as a storage facility, once they decommission the facility and the material can either be stored on site or has the possibility to be stored in Texas, is that correct?
Yeah, well, there's various classifications of waste material that's left over from this plant. First and foremost is the spent fuel, and that's the fuel that has gone through the process of splitting atoms to produce heat, to produce electricity. The spent fuel rods have been put into what's called dry cask storage. There are five casks that you know, heavily engineered casks with steel, lead, a variety of different kinds of materials where these fuel rods are stored, because there is no place in the United States to put these. Yucca Mountain was supposed to be the place to put these, but that's not happening and probably not will never happen. So this material is stored on site. I feel very confident. Again, the committee was involved in a lot of the decision-making process in terms of how this material will be stored. It's in these casks that are stored below grade in a bunker. So if you can visualize the concept of a coffee cup holder in your car, you take these casks and you put them in this bunker, and so they're there, and regardless of how much jiggling your car does, regardless of how what kind of an earthquake we have here, those casks probably won't fall. They won't fall over. They probably won't crack open. So in terms of earthquake hazards, it's very, very safe, I believe. In terms of tsunami, it's below grade, so if a tsunami wave were to breach the 45-foot wall or mountain that this is stored in right there on site, it would wash over. So I think the high-level spent fuel waste is, for now, very well stored, and we need to recognize that it's going to be here for possibly a very, very long time. I mean, possibly forever. I would hope not, but at least within my lifetime, and probably within the lifetime of most of the listeners out there, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, this material is going to stay there. Okay, so that said and done, I think we've done a pretty good job isolating and safeguarding that. The rest of the material, the piping, the equipment, the concrete, all of that stuff that has become irradiated is going to go off-site. And there are basically three or four places in the United States that are accepting those. The one that takes most of the, what we call the low-level waste, the concrete rubble and things like that, is located in Utah, in a place called Clive, Utah. Some of our waste, some of the piping and some of the materials has gone up to a couple of companies up in the Hanford, Washington area. There's a new waste site that supposedly is going to open in April in Texas, and some of our a little bit more radioactive materials, Class C kind of waste, is hopefully going to go there. But again, there are a lot of issues. But whatever happens, at some point, this material will be removed from the site here and put someplace where it won't threaten Humboldt Bay.
Certainly, and I think something that's important to note is in designing the facility to store these containers, they have to plan that they will never be moved. So when they're designing them for time immemorial, if you will. So the cost of doing that is expensive, and so there's obviously those economic issues of how do you design something to store all this waste that may or may not be there in 50 years.
So these casks for the high-level waste, yes, they are stored to last a long time, designed to last a long time, but they are what we call transportable casks, so that if some place opens up, whether it's Yucca Mountain or whether it's Texas or Utah or wherever we decide, and one of the things that the government is looking at is finding a temporary monitored site where we can store all of our waste before it goes into a deep repository. That's fine and dandy. The thing I like about the way we store those casks here is that it is monitored. So, gee, 50 years, 100 years down the road, or whenever, something happens and one of these casks does, by some chance, create a leak or a flaw of some kind, it's being monitored and we go in and fix it, as opposed to taking this material and burying it 2 miles below the surface of the earth where, you know, something happens 10 years, 50 years, 1,000 years, 100,000 years from now, not much you can do.
out of sight, not out of mind. At that point, I'd like to ask a little bit about the monitoring. You know, you said that they are going to be monitoring that. What kind of monitoring process do they have set up as of now, and what kind of plans are they discussing for future?
I'm not privy to all of the real technical stuff that they're doing in terms of monitoring. They monitor air, they monitor water. They monitor the casks in terms of temperature changes, things along that. Just kind of common engineering practices. in terms of looking at the facility, the power plant itself, there's been a lot of monitoring going on with, there's wells that surround this whole facility in which samples are taken, I would say, on a daily or weekly basis, in which tracking movement of water, tracking movement of contaminants, things along that line. So that's all pretty much standard engineering processes. And I would think that our government regulators would, you know, force that these things, you know, be kept current.
Certainly. And I think something you discussed earlier is that, you know, the people who are working on these projects, you know, they're local. They live in our area. They want this site to be cleaned up as well. You know, they have a vested interest in making sure that their home is clean. And yeah, we don't see anything changing anytime soon. So as far as, you know, the involvement of the public and what public can do to kind of support your efforts, support the efforts of the board and the advisory board, that is, and kind of make sure that they stay abreast of all the situations that are going on, both locally and abroad, what do you suggest people do?
Well, one word, education. Educate yourself. And there's, with the advent of the internet and with everything that's out there, you know, the information is almost overwhelming. But I think on a local level, people just need to educate themselves as to what the process of decommissioning is, what the problems are, and what impacts we're doing here will have on the rest of the, let's just focus on the nation, okay? We find that, yes, we're going to learn a lot from this decommissioning. We're going to learn a lot of very positive things, and we're going to learn a lot of very negative things. The power plant was built for $33 million in 1962. In 1987, when the first decommissioning plan was filed, the decommissioning costs were supposed to be $95 million. 4 years ago, that had jumped to $387 million. Today, it's $600 million, and we're not finished. So whether that's going to stay at $600 million, maybe drop down to $550 million, go to $750 million, nobody knows. The nuclear industry, in terms of managing its cost estimates, has done a very dismal job. And so the costs and the issues of decommissioning have to be, I guess, brought to the forefront of the general public. Right now, the state of Georgia, I'll kind of use Georgia as a little example here, the state of Georgia is going to build two new nuclear reactors. Last year, they started charging their customers, their ratepayers, a small fee to build these. Now, that's kind of something new. We've never done that before. The federal government is subsidizing the construction of those two reactors to a tune of about $8.5 billion. And that's everybody. It's not just ratepayers. It's not just people who are going to benefit from those two power plants. It's everybody. You and I are paying for Georgia's power plants. The cost of those two power plants is, again, somewhere around $14 billion. Again, my personal gut feeling, I've watched this game being played for 40 years, and it's not going to be $14 billion. It's going to be way, way more than that. Whether these plants actually even get built is another big question. If they are built, the cost of the electricity that they will produce just might be overwhelmingly high compared to other renewable costs, which are really, really coming down. And so, again, one point I want to make is that when we try to compare nuclear power with other energy sources, nuclear has always, always, always been increasing in costs. And we're looking at solar, wind, we're looking at renewables, in which one of the big problems with solar today is that the cost is coming down. And, gee, you build a plant to build a photovoltaic module, and gee, it's obsolete because the cost is coming down. Somebody else can do it cheaper. So there's a whole manner of economics that has to kind of come into this whole play. The other big issue is the decommissioning process. The state of Vermont has Vermont Yankee, and that plant was supposed to be shut down next year. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission supposedly is going to give it a 20-year license extension, which I personally think is a bad idea. It's like taking your 1972 Oldsmobile and saying that, gee, I've got 250,000 miles on this, but you know what? I can run it for another 100,000 miles. Well, okay. The reason why relicensing is so important is because these companies cannot afford to build. We cannot afford to build many new reactors, so we're going to run these old ones until we run them into the ground or until something happens that basically kind of shuts the whole process down. In terms of, just want to mention the issue in Fukushima a year ago, almost to the date, we find an accident that was unprecedented, not just one reactor failure as was in Chernobyl or Three Mile Island. It was basically three reactor failures and failure in the spent fuel pool of all four reactors there. This was totally unheard of in a very, very highly technological society. Of course, you we're all hearing that, this can never happen here. Well, anytime I hear the word never, kind of raises a few hackles on my back, because I think we're really playing with a very, very intense fire.
Oh, and I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that, you know, the cost of nuclear to design the facility, to decommission the facility, the environmental cost, you know, these are huge, huge costs. And our ability to turn towards renewable energy, we really need to look at that option, because that's the viable option for our future. And I want to thank you so much for being with us and for the work you've done on the board and all of your work learning about nuclear energy and helping us learn about nuclear energy and keeping us abreast of what's going on. And hopefully we get to have you back when there's been more momentum locally. Before we end, I'd like to remind everyone that today is World Water Day, and to take a moment to think about what water means to you, what Humboldt Bay means to you, what living on the coast means to you, and what having a clean, reliable source of drinking water means to you, and what that would mean if everyone had the same abilities. This has been the Eco News Report. My name is Beth Werner, and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guest today has been Mike Meninas, a community advisory board member for PG&E for their Humboldt Bay's power plant decommissioning process. You can find out more information about Humboldt Baykeeper at www.humboldtbaykeeper.org and more information about the decommissioning process at PG&E's website. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on KHSU's website at khsu.org, where the programs are archived for 2 weeks after they are aired. Previous shows are posted on the NEC, the North Coast Environmental Center's website, at yournec.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener hotline at 826-6089. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here at KHSU for the Eco News Report.